love to just welcome everyone to tonight's Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic is Model Laws of Deep Decarbonization. We're going to have the chance to join Michael Girard for training on the legal pathways to deep decarbonization. And this research has provided essentially a legal playbook for deep decarbonization in the United States, identifying well over 1,000 legal options based on two reports from the Deep Decarbonization Pathways Project, or DDPP for short, that will explain technical and policy pathways for reducing US greenhouse gas emissions by at least 80% of 1990 levels by mid-century and get us on track. To present tonight, we have our esteemed advisory board member, the wonderful Michael Girard, and I'm just gonna give a little bit of background to give a taste for all that Michael has done with his career and how honored we are to have him on the line tonight. And then I'll pass it to Michael for the rest of tonight's training. So a little bit about Michael. Michael Girard is Andrew Sabin Professor of Professional Practice at Columbia Law School and teaches courses on environmental law, climate change law, and energy regulation, as well as being the director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law. He is also a member and former chair of the faculty of Columbia University's Earth Institute. From 1979 to 2008, Michael practiced environmental law full-time in New York, most recently as partner in charge of the New York office of Arnold & Porter. Girard was the 2004 and 5 chair of the American Bar Association's 10,000 member section of Environment, Energy, and Resources. He served on the executive committees of the boards of the Environmental Law Institute and the American College of Environmental Lawyers, and had several independent rating services ranked Girard as the leading environmental lawyer in New York and one of the leading environmental lawyers in the world. We have him with us tonight on tonight's webinar. A prolific writer in environmental law and climate change, Michael has written and edited 13 books and twice received the Association of American Publishers Best Law Book Award for works on environmental law and brownfields. So with that, we are so honored for you to have the time to join us tonight, Michael. And we are looking forward to all the wisdom that you're going to impart us.
Thank you, Brett. It's an honor to be with you all virtually this evening. I appreciate the invitation to spend this time with you. I'm going to start by, I was asked for the origin story. I'm going to say where this project came from, the technical work that underpins it, then the legal work that we have done to see how the U.S. can change its laws to be on these technical pathways. And then I'll talk about some of the ways that I hope many of you can become involved in carrying forward with this work. So around 2014, a big project was called the Deep Decarbonization Pathways Project. It was a report, it was a big study of 16 major emitting nations looking at how each of those nations could greatly reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. These 16 countries added up to about 3/4 of total global greenhouse gas emissions. The engineers and modelers who put together this report made sort of this assumption as to what total global greenhouse gas emissions would be out to the year 2050. Each of these bands of color represents a country. And so at the bottom is China. China is the largest emitting country in the world. Used to be the US, but we were surpassed by China. This assumes that emissions in China will peak at 2030, which is what their pledge has been. The green bar is India. Now the population of India will be surpassing that of China in a few years. And if India were assumed to have the same per capita emissions as China, this would be a much wider band, but that's what the assumption was made here. This blue area is the US. And as you can see, emissions from the US need to NIC down very considerably by 2050. So we often hear, what good does it do if we're not reducing our emissions, but China and India keep it up? What this tries to show is that regardless of what the rest of the world does, unless the U.S. very significantly reduces our emissions, there's no way that the world will be anywhere near this kind of pathway. All these other bands are the other 13 countries among the 16 that they looked at. Now, of course, no UN body or any other body has officially adopted this scenario. This is just a model, but it gives you a sense of where the US stands related to the other countries. So this technical report led to this report, Pathways to Deep Decarbonization in the United States. And this report and some more recent work show that there are really four pillars in order to achieve this. The first pillar is electricity decarbonization, moving entirely away from fossil fuels to generate electricity in the United States, with the possible exception of some peaking from a little bit of peaking from natural gas to make up for the intermittency of wind and solar. But for the most part, we've gotten rid of fossil fuels to generate electricity, replaced by wind and solar and hydro and geothermal, and a continuation of the existing nuclear plants to the extent that they can be operated safely. Not build any new ones in the next several decades unless a major new technology arises. So this is the first benchmark, electricity decarbonization. The second is energy efficiency. Try to run the economy as efficiently as possible, leading to a 40% reduction in per capita final energy demand. The third pillar is electrification, moving away from direct fossil fuel use to electricity for as many uses as we possibly can, led by passenger transport. So all passenger vehicles by 2050 under this scenario would be electric. For heavy duty vehicles, the battery technology may not be adequate for that to work, so that might be hydrogen fuel cells or some other kind of technology. It would also involve moving to electricity for building heating and water heating. Right now, a lot of building heating and water heating is done by either oil or natural gas. That would be converted to electricity. And if all the electricity is coming from clean sources, that goes a very long way toward eliminating greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. The fourth pillar is carbon capture. There are some industrial sources like cement and steel manufacture, aluminum manufacture, where by the nature of the processes, it's very hard to eliminate their greenhouse gas emissions. Work has been done on that, but we're not there yet. So we would need to capture the CO2 emitted from those industrial sources and from any remaining fossil fuel electricity sources, although hopefully they'll all be gone by 2050. We also need to remove a great deal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, from the ambient air, in order to meet the temperature goals. So that's another important pillar. The technical report made a number of assumptions. It assumed that we would have the same amount of electricity reliability we now have. Now, if you're in California, you may not be thrilled right now about electricity reliability, but for the most part of the country, it's very good. We'd have the same amount of energy services provided as before. We're not relying on any technology that is not yet at or near commercial scale. We're assuming the technical people who wrote the report are assuming a continuation of economic growth and population growth in the United States. So all of those are built into the models. The models also take a close look at what is the expected lifetime of each of the kinds of equipment. So electric lighting changes that every few years. So to the extent there are remaining incandescent light bulbs, they can all be replaced by LED light bulbs within the normal life cycle of light bulbs. Hot water heaters typically last for 10 or 12 years. So the assumption throughout is that you don't have to get rid of your existing appliances or equipment, but when they reach the end of their useful life, you replace it with something much more energy efficient or electrified. So that is considered throughout this analysis, the inertia of the capital stock. The assumptions about what happens going out to 2050, the gasoline-powered internal combustion engine is pretty much phased out. No more of them are made in the United States, but we still have a few old clunkers around, but that's mostly gone. Diesel internal combustion engines are largely phased out, and we have replaced with electric vehicles, and then for heavy-duty vehicles, hydrogen fuel cells. It is assumed that as we move to electrification, there will be less need for liquid fuels, but there will still be some need for liquid fuels, aircraft, certain other uses, but we see a great decline in the use of these liquid fuels and replacement to the extent they still are needed, largely by biofuels. Electricity, if we're going to electrify passenger transport and electrify home heating and building heating and water heating, we're going to need a whole lot more electricity, even after the 40% improvement in efficiency. And so we're going to need about a doubling of the total amount of electricity generated in the United States. And all of that has to be from clean sources. We're not going to be building any new fossil fuel sources. So here we see fossil energy is largely, you know, phased out, and to the extent you have any of it left, it almost all of it has carbon capture and sequestration. And it's going to be replaced mostly by wind. You have a continuation of hydro, and you have more solar, particularly in the latter years. But all this new electricity, this massive amount of new electricity we need, is coming from renewable sources. So there are several scenarios, but let's just look at this one. This is what happens on a net basis to U.S. Greenhouse gas emissions going from 2020. And under this scenario, by 2050, we're actually going to net negative emissions, which is where we need to be in order to meet the temperature targets. So with this technical report, another law professor, John Dernbach, who's with Widener University Law School in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, John and I asked the question, how does U.S. law need to change in order for the U.S. to be on this technical pathway? Federal law, state law, and local law. So we launched this project. We recruited a total of about 50 lawyers from around the United States, mostly law professors, some with NGOs and private practice, to put together this book. We started work on it in 2015. Our hope was that we would finish it in early 2017 in order to present the results to the incoming Hillary Clinton administration. But the book finally came out in April of 2019, published by the Environmental Law Institute, 1,200 pages. And we also did an abridged volume. And in the chat is a link that'll take you to where you can buy the book. ELI is charging a steep discount, so it's $64.95. And the PDF of the abridged volume is available for free download. So we looked at what are the legal tools that are available. And of course, we started with a price on carbon. We think that a price on carbon is a very important element of this. The price on carbon, as all of you know, goes throughout the economy. You impose it upstream at the oil well or gas well or coal mine or import terminal. And so everything downstream from that sees the price depending on market conditions, and that should spur a lot of energy efficiency and energy conservation and innovation. So that's an extremely important tool. However, unlike what some economists say, we don't think it's enough, that having a carbon price alone will not do the trick. And there are several reasons for this. One of them is that, you know, we need a massive amount of new renewables, and some of that faces local opposition and other hurdles. As most of you know, back in around 2011, there was a proposal to build a big wind farm in Nantucket Sound off Cape Cod called Cape Wind. It would have been the first offshore wind project in the United States. It faced multiple lawsuits, multiple regulatory hurdles, lots of other problems, and the project has essentially been abandoned. Now, it wasn't because of a lack of a price on carbon. The developers had every incentive to build it. There were other obstacles that it faced, and what we have seen is that continues to be the case for many renewable energy projects around the country, and so we need additional tools beyond a carbon tax to deal with that. Some emissions are hard to measure, such as leakage from natural gas pipelines. You can't tax what you can't measure. And so that's another shortcoming of a carbon tax. We have the principal agent problem in that some of the companies that would be exposed to the tax are not the companies whose behavior we want to change. So for example, if you're in a building, the fuel bills are typically paid by the tenant, but the decision on how energy efficient the building is going to be are made by the builder. The builder doesn't have to pay the carbon tax, and so the builder doesn't care about the energy efficiency of the building because the tenants pay the bills. And so that's another shortcoming. Some sectors of the economy have low price elasticity, that raising the price on carbon wouldn't have much effect on what they do. So for example, uses of hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs, used for refrigeration and other things, it's not very price elastic. So putting a tax on HFCs wouldn't do a lot. As we all know, the political realities are different, are difficult. It's hard politically to get the price high enough to really make a difference. We all know about the yellow vest protests in France a couple of years ago, where the price of gasoline went up and it led to mass protests. That has sort of spooked a lot of people around the world who support a carbon tax. Some sectors have long lead times in making decisions on what they need to do. They need more certainty than a price can provide. The automobile manufacturer is a major example of that. For some of this, we need public infrastructure construction, and I'm thinking particularly of the construction of new electric power lines. And finally, the price on carbon doesn't necessarily affect the non-carbon externalities of many of these activities, such as mining waste from fossil fuel extraction. So for all of these reasons, we start with a carbon price, but we need a lot of other techniques on top of that. And so we identified a total of 12 different kinds of techniques. Additional regulation is the most obvious of them. Reduction or removal of legal barriers for doing certain things. Removal of incentives for fossil fuel use, like fossil fuel subsidies, which are essentially a negative carbon tax. We want to get rid of all of those. Tradable permits or allowances, information so that consumers will be informed about what are the energy and greenhouse gas consequences of their purchases and operations, and then various other techniques are all in the mix. The next several slides that I'm going to show So each bullet is a chapter in the book, 35 chapters in the book, trying to cover basically all the major ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So one long section concerns energy efficiency, conservation, and fuel switching. And we start with light duty vehicles, which I've already talked about. How the idea is that over the next several years, we crank down the corporate average fuel economy standards. But in a few years, we think that we need basically a ban on the manufacture of internal combustion engine driven passenger vehicles in the US. And their replacement with electric vehicles. For heavy duty vehicles, as I say, we need to move away from diesel, which runs most of them, to alternative fuel sources, most likely hydrogen fuel cells or something else, unless battery technology develops to the point that it'll work for long distance trucking, for example. Transportation demand and mode shifting, trying to move people away from single occupancy cars, ideally into walking or bicycling or mass transit. A lot of this is a matter of land use and whether you have the densities to support mass transit. This tends to take a much longer time to take effect, but it's in the mix. Aviation is very tricky. In the first place, you know, much aviation is international. The US has limited control over that. There is work on more use of biofuels to reduce the use of fossil fuels to power aircraft. There's some preliminary work on electric-powered airplanes, you know, sort of small, short-distance planes, and over the decades, hopefully that will improve the various improvements in air operation. Obviously, the thing that none of us wanted to happen, but the COVID crisis has greatly reduced air traffic. Not as much, not proportional to the reduction in ridership, because of course you have a lot of empty seats on purpose. Anyway, aviation is a challenge. Shipping is also difficult, although there are new technologies as well as some really old technologies. There's some use of wind to supplement the engines. Lighting appliances and other equipment is one area where there's tremendous progress and much more can be achieved. The elimination, the law that essentially bans the manufacture of new incandescent light bulbs in the US, and that has led to the replacement of most incandescent light bulbs with CFLs and now LEDs, has saved the equivalent of the generation of about 11 nuclear power plants. So it's not a small thing. That's just light bulbs, the equivalent of 11 nuclear power plants by switching to LEDs on a nationwide basis. We've seen tremendous improvements in energy efficiency and refrigerators and other appliances. There's much more that could be done. The federal law gives the Department of Energy the authority to crank down energy efficiency standards on lots of appliances that needs to be revived and strengthened. Buildings, of course, are one of the biggest sectors in generating emissions, now either directly or through the electricity that they buy. For new buildings, one could easily imagine requiring all new buildings to be all electric and highly energy efficient. Conceptually, that's not so hard. You'll have a lot of local resistance to it. A federal law doing that would upset traditional federal state relations, but it's imaginable. Existing buildings are much tougher. Retrofitting an existing building that has oil heat or natural gas heat to turn it into electric heat, probably using heat pumps, is an expensive, elaborate process. And requiring all the owners of the tens of millions of buildings in the United States to do that is challenging. But the book does have a number of recommendations to increase the incentives for doing that. Localities, you know, certainly would have the ability, some already do that, at least when you have a major renovation in a building, that you have to change out its heating system. So there are a number of ways to ease into it, but that's challenging. Then the industrial sector is quite varied. We have lots of heavy industries that emit a lot of greenhouse gases, and each of them has its own physical process that has to be dealt with in its own way. Now, a carbon tax would accomplish a lot. The carbon tax would create significant incentives for the industries to develop and deploy new technologies. Meanwhile, until all that happens on an industry by industry basis, there are a lot of things that can be done to reduce their emissions. So this is the category energy efficiency, conservation, and fuel switching. The next category is electricity decarbonization, is moving away from fossil fuels to generate electricity. So we have a long chapter, which I wrote, about utility scale renewables. As I say, we need just a breathtaking amount of new onshore wind, offshore wind, utility scale solar, rooftop solar. I don't know that we'll have a lot of new hydro, but we need to keep the hydro we have. In within the continental US, there's capacity for more run of the river hydro. There are a lot of dams out there that don't have generators on them, so you can put generators on them so they generate electricity. There's a great deal of potential to import more hydropower from Canada, which has surplus supply. There are controversies associated with that, but that is a possibility. So the siting of these utility scale renewables often takes a very long time, because going through the environmental impact statement process under the National Environmental Policy Act, working through the Endangered Species Act, getting the land that's necessary. If it's federal land, it's one process. If it's private land, it's another process. But the book does go through a lot of specific recommendations on how to speed that all up. Distributed renewables, such as solar rooftop, are another very important tool. Now, calculations have been shown that if you put solar panels on the roof of every building in the US that has a suitably size and shape and configured roof, you'd go a long way, but it's hard to imagine laws that require everybody who owns a building with such a roof to put solar on their roof at their own expense. So we do have a number of recommendations to how to encourage that, how to make it easier to get the local permits, how to have other economic incentives and net metering from the power companies in various ways to approve that. So the utility scale solar all needs transmission lines to carry the electricity from where the power is generated to where it's needed. The US has fallen behind in its construction of new electric transmission lines. Much of our existing transmission infrastructure is very old. We need a whole lot more. There is a federal law that tries to improve the siting. It has completely failed. The siting of electric transmission lines is almost entirely a matter of state law. Some states do it really well, led by Texas. Some don't. So a number of states don't want a power line that is going through the state from one end to the other, but doesn't benefit their own consumers. But of course, with utility scale solar, you need a lot of that. So we propose various changes to federal law as well as state law to improve the siting of these needed transmission lines to handle the doubling of the electricity supply that's needed, and also the associated electricity storage to make up for, to be one factor in making up for the fact that the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine. So storage helps resolve that problem of intermittent renewables. With nuclear, as I said, the economics of building new nuclear in the United States have become impossible. The surest way for an electric utility these days to go bankrupt is to try to build a new nuclear power plant. So nobody's doing it, and it's completely unfinanceable, leaving aside the safety issues. But we do now have, I think the latest number is 98 operating nuclear power plants in the US. And our recommendation is, so long as they can continue to operate safely, they should continue, because they're a very important source of baseload 24/7 low emissions electricity until we can completely phase them out. I just talked about hydropower for a minute. And then we have various legal techniques to accelerate the phase out of fossil fuels to generate electricity. Under the Obama administration, the principal method was the Clean Power Plan. The Supreme Court stayed the Clean Power Plan without explanation. That's a whole other story. In February of 2016, Trump campaigned that he would kill the Clean Power Plan. He did that. That has been replaced by something called the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, which is neither affordable nor clean. But anyway, there's a lot of litigation now pending about that. But I think that if the Biden-Harris ticket wins in November, that they will reshuffle the whole thing and reintroduce some form of serious regulation of fossil fuel-fired power plants that will accelerate their phase out. Although, of course, coal has been declining on its own for lots of economic reasons for years. The next category here is fuel decarbonization. So, as I said, we will still need some liquid fuels, aircraft, perhaps for some long distance transport, maybe for construction equipment, for various other purposes. Emergency generators. We'll also need some gaseous fuels. Not everything can be electrified. Given that reality, to the extent we still need liquid fuels or gaseous fuels, the hope of the technical reports, as we talk about in our legal report, is to convert as much of that as possible to biofuels or fuels from biological sources. But it's important to do that in a way that does not take land away from agricultural production, from food production, and that recognizes what are the highest priority uses of these biofuels. So we talk in a lot of detail about where this biofuel would come from, how to minimize the environmental impact, how to produce it and deliver it. So I mentioned the need for carbon capture from industrial sources, and to the extent that they remain fossil fuel electricity generating sources, that will require technology at the power plants or the industrial sources to remove the CO2 before it goes up the smokestack. So far, the technological development of carbon sequestration for power plants has not gone well. There were a few pilot projects that were extremely expensive, and some that were actually shut down after the expenditure and loss of several billion dollars. There were two of these plants that actually became operational, one in Canada, in Saskatchewan, and one in Texas called Petranova. But the Petranova plant actually was mothballed about 2 weeks ago. It became uneconomical. So we're not sure what the future holds for that. There are, in other parts of the world, successful uses of carbon capture for certain industrial processes. Question then becomes, what do you do with the CO2 that you have captured? Ideally, you would put it to some use. There's some use in turning it into fuels. There's work going on in embedding it in concrete and various other products. But failing that, it needs to go into geologic storage. It's not clear that a lot of people want to live on top of a carbon dioxide reservoir. There's work on doing it in the subsea bid, but so that we talk about all the legal issues associated with that. Then there's, as I mentioned, the issue of direct air capture, removing the CO2 from the atmosphere. There are about half a dozen sort of technologies, sort of mechanical technologies that would do this that are under development. There's some thought of ocean-based methods of doing that with algae of a particular kind. This is an area where a lot more R&D is necessary, and it would need massive subsidies or a carbon tax to make it economical. We do have provision of the federal tax law called Section 45Q, which is encouraging some work in that area. The technical report on which we relied did not really talk about agriculture or forestry. It's not as easy to quantify the emissions reductions that changes would achieve, but John Dernbach and I thought it was very important to include them. So we do have a very lengthy chapter on agriculture and ways that farm operations, particularly soils management, can be changed to change a lot of agricultural activity from net generators to net absorbers of CO2. A lot of that could be accomplished through changes in the structure of farm subsidies. And we talk in a lot of detail about that. With forestry, a lot of talk about planting a million trees or a billion trees and planting a massive amount of trees. Two particular problems with that. Where do you find and acquire the land in order to do all of that? Again, without taking farmland out of production, getting the land and acquiring use of it is tricky. And of course, trees, like every other living being, are mortal. They die, and when they die, they release their CO2 back into the atmosphere. So it's a temporary fix. It's not a permanent fix. But we do talk about what can be done to improve forest management and forest growth and regrowth to use forestry as a tool. Then there are a number of climate pollutants other than carbon dioxide. Most of the attention goes to carbon dioxide because that's the largest in terms of the overall impact. But there are several other pollutants, and each has its own sort of characteristics and its own potential control methods. Black carbon, a lot of it is very, very fine particles. A lot of it comes from diesel engines. And so eliminating the use of diesel engines is very helpful. There are industrial sources, other sources of black carbon. In other parts of the world, a great deal of it comes from cooking with primitive fuels. Methane, natural gas is mostly methane. We are learning increasingly in recent years that an awful lot of it leaks. Once again, the Trump administration is trying to cut back on the leak, on the regulation of the leakage of natural gas. We in the book talk about a lot of legal techniques that can be employed to reduce it. Fluorinated gases used for refrigeration and various other processes are very, very highly effective as greenhouse gases in small quantities. There was an international agreement reached in 2015 called the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol that aims to reduce that. Once again, the Trump administration has not been enthusiastic about that, but hopefully that'll pick up. And finally, nitrous oxide. A lot of that comes from soil management, including fertilizer use. There are other sources, but we get into legal techniques to cut that back. Then there are the cross-cutting approaches that cut across all different sectors. I've already talked about carbon pricing. Changes in consumer behavior through more information and shifting of norms, various techniques to do that. We talk about the way the law can spur technological innovation, the R&D that we need. We talk about financing techniques for large-scale projects, small-scale projects. And importantly, we conclude that although the capital expenditures that would be needed for this essential energy transition are very significant, they are well within the range of capital expenditures that the U.S. has been undertaking for a very long time, that they're actually a pretty small percentage of what traditional capital expenditures are. So it's well within the capacity of the U.S. financial system to handle the financing if the necessary incentives are there. There's also talk about ways to reduce consumption of materials, to have more of a circular economy, to reduce food waste, to do lots of other things to reduce waste and plastic waste and the other things that add to greenhouse gas emissions. And then finally, international trade has been used by the US and also by China and Japan and some other countries in a way that inhibits the growth of renewables, tariffs on solar panels, for instance. So tariffs on wind turbines. We talk about how those international trade barriers that increase the cost of renewables can be relaxed. So that essentially is the book. But we didn't want the book just to go on the shelf or in the hard drive. We wanted something to come of it. So we've started a couple of projects to follow up. The first is the drafting of model laws. There are more than 1,000 laws that are recommended by the book. Somebody has to write them all. So we started this project, the Model Laws for Deep Decarbonization Project, to recruit lawyers on a pro bono basis to draft these laws. So far, about 23 major law firms have signed up, and a number of individual lawyers who are now at work drafting these model laws. A fellow named Rick Horsch, who recently retired as an environmental partner in the New York-based law firm of White & Case, has on a volunteer basis taken up the job of coordinating and supervising all of this pro bono drafting work that is happening. We need more lawyers to do this. We don't have enough lawyers. We're looking for more. If anybody knows anybody who might be interested, please have them contact me. It also became apparent that one significant drag on the construction of the new renewables that we need is local opposition. And so we've started something called the Renewable Energy Legal Defense Initiative, whose purpose is to provide pro bono legal representation to community groups and others who want wind and solar and other renewables, but that are facing opposition in their communities. So the law firm where I was a partner for many years, Arnold and Porter, seconded a senior litigation associate, Laura Cottingham, to spend half her time for a year working on that project. That year was 2019. That's now been taken over by one of the lawyers who works for me at the Sabin Center, Hilary Adon. So we're representing on a pro bono basis some community groups that want wind and solar. We've created a website, Model Laws for Deep Decarbonization in the United States. Let's get started. And you'll see the various large categories in which the chapters are arranged. And let's just go to, let's say, electricity decarbonization. And these are the particular chapters. One of them is distributed renewables. Click on that. And you'll see here the various topics. And let's go to the distributed energy resources permitting and zoning practices. And here you'll see the various recommendations from our legal pathways to deep decarbonization. And then you scroll down here and you see a whole lot of model laws and other resources that are associated with it. So here, Massachusetts model zoning law for solar regulation of solar energy systems. and you can go here and download the actual model law. So we've got something like 850 of these model laws up there, and are drafting, most drafted by others so far, but we have more coming. We need help. We need volunteers. We need help from lawyers to draft these model laws and to peer review the model laws. We need help from citizens to take these model laws out to Congress and to state legislatures and to city councils to get them passed. And this is a huge job that needs to be done all over the country. And then everybody, obviously between now and November, there's no question that the most important decision that's coming up is what's happening on November 3rd. And I'm not going to announce any endorsements, but anything anybody can do for voter registration, for voter turnout, for election protection, between now and November 3rd, I would say that that's the most important thing that can be done. But past that, we need to have these model laws enacted. The world is telling us this has to be done. We're seeing fires and tornadoes and fire tornadoes and droughts and hurricanes and melting sea ice and extreme flooding. All of this is actually happening at a faster pace than most scientists had predicted even 5 years ago. This absolutely has to be done. So bless all of you for doing this work. Please keep it up. Bring your friends in. And we all need to do everything we possibly can to try to soften this planetary crisis.
Here's to that. It's all hands on deck, and we couldn't be prouder to be coalition partners with you, Michael. So thank you for all the important work and essential research your team has headed up here, and we look forward to putting it to work throughout the larger country and world.
Brett, thank you so much, and thank you to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.